Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Criminal Law and Procedure Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, October 5th, 2017, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's telephone conference call. This afternoon, we are hosting a courthouse steps discussion on two Supreme Court cases, the District of Columbia v. Westby and Class v. United States. My name is Wesley Hodges, and I'm the Associate Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of our expert on today's call. Today, we are fortunate to have with us William J. Hahn, who is an associate at Sherman and Sterling LLP. After our speaker gives his remarks, we will turn to an audience Q&A. Thank you for speaking with us, William. The floor is now yours.
Thank you very much. It's a privilege to be speaking with the Federalist Society today on some interesting cases of criminal procedure that were before the Supreme Court this week. Interesting not only because of the particular issues they present, but also because they're both somewhat unusual cases in comparison to the Supreme Court's typical menu of cases. In both arguments, as will be borne out as we discuss them, there were a number of very fact-bound issues and lots of record-oriented questions and disputes, and less legal issue, less of a legal focus, strictly speaking, as a more sort of factual focus, given both of these cases. Although one of the perhaps joys of having more fact-bound cases is that you get to really revel in some of the interesting facts of the cases. And in the first case we had, Westby, no shortage of interesting facts here. I mean, the legal issues themselves are whether or not the D.C. police officers involved had probable cause to arrest a group of people who were attending a party in a vacant home, and even if they did not, whether the lawsuit would be dismissed via summary judgment because the officers are entitled to qualified immunity. Those are the legal issues, but the facts, they get so much more interesting. So they start back in March of 2008, where officers arrived to investigate a report from multiple neighbors complaining of a party and illegal activities at an unoccupied house in Southeast D.C. When the two officers approached the house, there were 21 people or so inside the house. They ran upstairs. They moved into different rooms. And the officers kind of surmised that there had indeed been some kind of a party going on. They found women who had been apparently selling lap dances and were dressed only in their bras and thongs with money hanging out of garter belts. The officers also reportedly smelled marijuana. Some of the people the officers spoke with on the premises said that they had been invited to the house by someone named Peaches or Tasty. And they told the officers that Peaches / Tasty had given them permission to be there, while Peaches herself gave the officers conflicting accounts about whether she had permission to be in the house from the house's owner. She was not the house's owner. When the police officers did eventually get in touch with the owner, he had confirmed that he had not authorized anyone, let alone Peaches / Tasty, to be in his house. So the officers arrested the 21 people for trespassing, and they took them to the station. The commanding officer charged them not with trespassing, but with disorderly conduct. Eventually, the charges were dropped, but 16 of the 21 that were arrested went into federal court, arguing that the police had lacked probable cause to arrest them for disorderly conduct. The district court agreed with the partygoers. They ruled that, the police hadn't learned anything during their investigation at the house to suggest that the partygoers, and this is sort of critical language here, knew or should have known that they were entering against the owner's will. It's the mens rea, if you will, the mental guilty mind needed to commit the offense. The district court said that didn't exist, and so after a trial, the court ordered the officers to pay nearly $700,000 plus attorney's fees to the partygoers. The D.C. Circuit affirmed the decision of the trial court. It concluded that the officers lacked probable cause to arrest the partygoers because they had no reason to believe, again, speaking to the mens rea, that the partygoers either knew or should have known that they were not allowed in the house. In the court's view, the homeowner's statement to the police that he had not given anyone permission, let alone Peaches/Tasty, who apparently authorized everyone else to come into the house, that that was not enough because the homeowner, in the court's view, never said that he or anyone else had told the partygoers that they were not welcome, that there had to be some kind of affirmative, contrary representation of not being welcome. The court further reasoned that there was no evidence that the officers had asked either Peaches or the homeowner whether the partygoers knew that Peaches had no right to be in the house. The full Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit denied rehearing en banc over the dissent of four judges, Judges Brown, Kavanaugh, Griffith, and Henderson. And the District of Columbia government and the officers then asked the Supreme Court to weigh in via a certiorari petition, and the Supreme Court agreed to do so after holding the case over for rehearing several times, which is highly unusual. The argument, again, focusing on those two legal questions of whether there was probable cause and whether, if not, nevertheless, qualified immunity prevented the officers from being held individually liable, really focused again on these kind of factual questions about probable cause. And as I mentioned at the beginning of the call, one of the sort of fun things about having a very fact-bound case, not only is it unusual for the court, but we get interesting insights like the party habits of Justice Breyer and Justice Kagan in their earlier days, and Justice Kennedy, who had perhaps the most amusing line of all of oral arguments, saying, "So Peaches, a woman, is the host at a bachelor party." And so going with that kind of tenor in mind, the questions proceeded. The D.C. Solicitor General, Todd Kim, he really focused the justices on the standard of probable cause, saying that this is a standard, it's a practical standard. The judge is supposed to put him or herself in the officer's shoes. It's not a sort of second-guessing of the officer and what they experienced. It's not supplanting the inferences a judge would draw from what the officer would draw. And you have to account for the sort of practical limits that come when arresting someone, including an inability to look into the minds of the suspects, offering, of course, innocent explanations for their suspicious behavior. For the D.C. government, you know, the key facts to focus on were that Peaches wasn't even at the house. The homeowner told police that no one was supposed to be there. Peaches not only wasn't at the house, no one knew where she was, and she had no desire to come back to the house because she thought she was going to get arrested. And the 21 people fled when the officers got to the house. There were, however, you know, a number of justices pushed back on the inferences to draw from these facts. Justice Sotomayor, Justice Kagan, and Justice Ginsburg kind of all similarly focused on this idea of, well, look, I mean, a lot of people think, and Justice Breyer hit this topic too, that a lot of people think that, oh, if you get invited at some person's house, you just assume that it's okay to go to the person's house. And suddenly 50 people are there, as Justice Breyer was talking about, and no one really asks whether it's actually that person's house or whether they're actually allowed to be there. And this is no different than that. And the United States, arguing in support of the D.C. government, sort of responded to those questions, assisting the D.C. government's argument by saying, look, in this kind of scenario where the people going on there or the people at the house found themselves in compromising situations, the deck is kind of stacked against them. And Chief Justice Roberts kind of doubled down on that in his questioning or his responses, saying, reminding people that there was more going on here than just a wild party, as that I began the call with. I mean, there are a number of, shall we say, incriminating activities that the court found or that the officers found when they went into the house. Justice Breyer in particular kind of pressed the advocates for D.C. and the United States on this point, as did some of the more liberal justices. On the same token, though, Justice Breyer also kind of pressed the counsel for the partygoers, saying, look, you need to be putting yourself in the officer's shoes, sort of echoing D.C.'s point. The officers knew that the house was supposed to be vacant. It looked sort of vacant. And they knew that the parties in vacant houses had been a problem in this neighborhood. And so Justice Breyer is kind of getting at, well, why not all of this taken together leads a reasonable officer to think, well, these people probably knew it was a vacant house. And if a reasonable officer could have concluded that would be enough. There was also a sort of more technical discussion of what DC trespass law allowed. And the relevance of this, I think, goes, well, in two ways. There's a legal relevance to it, and then there's a more sort of factual, sort of thematic relevance to it. The legal relevance to it, it gets to the qualified immunity standard, because the qualified immunity standard doesn't just in order to pierce an officer's qualified immunity, one not must only show a violation of someone's constitutional rights, but that also the right at issue was clearly established in law, in the applicable law at the time. And this can't be defined at a very high level of generality, particularly in fact-bound cases like determining probable cause. While a case doesn't have to be squarely on point, a case does have to sort of govern the outcome. And the fact that there was these sort of opening interstitial questions about DC trespass law has some legal relevance to qualified immunity. But the justices really sort of clung to the more bigger thematic aspects of the DC trespass law. Justice Alito was saying, look, you know, what does it mean for a house to be vacant from a legal standpoint? Because the counsel for the party goers were saying, oh, well, you know, it's not really vacant as far as DC trespass law is concerned. There's plumbing, there's electricity, there's some furniture, mattresses, things like that. It's not really vacant from a legal perspective. But Justice Alito's saying, well, look, when the neighbors complain that there's a party in a vacant house, use your common sense. Do you think that they really mean vacant under D.C. law, or that simply, you know, no one's living there? And the counsel for the party goers agreed that they meant the latter. But he also thought and sort of responded that, you know, the officers should be able to consider the condition of the house, which might look different than in a less affluent neighborhood. Justice Alito had a lot of problems with taking the affluence of the neighborhood into account, as did Justice Gorsuch, when he sort of put out the point of, look, well, we all live with folding chairs for a time when we move. Why does the neighborhood's affluence have to do anything with it? Justice Sotomayor kind of jumped in on this topic as well, and while she didn't completely agree with the idea that the neighborhood or the wealth of the neighborhood should make a difference, she did sort of speculate that, you know, if police officers arrived at a wealthy home and there were white teenagers who were engaging in the facts that were laid out in this case, she doesn't think that the people would be arrested, and it's unusual, or it doesn't feel right, I believe she said to the D.C. Solicitor General, that 21 people en masse were arrested for going to a party. But again, you know, there's a sort of legal relevance to the difficult questions of D.C. trespass law, and that is sort of qualified immunity. And, you know, the big piece about qualified immunity that can often work to the favor of the officers is that the law, as I said, has to be the constitutional violation has to be clearly established in law at the time. And the D.C. Solicitor General made the point of, like, look, the fact that the justices are disagreeing about these issues right now, about what the standard for probable cause requires, particularly with respect to the mens rea at issue, along with the fact that four judges of the D.C. Circuit believe that there was probable cause on these facts, that's enough to establish that the constitutional question here is not plainly beyond debate, and the officers weren't plainly incompetent for thinking that probable cause existed on these facts, and therefore they get qualified immunity. There was some pushback from a partygoer's counselor saying, well, the officers were plainly incompetent because there was nothing to suggest that the partygoers knew that they weren't supposed to be in the house. But there, Justice Kagan kind of jumped in and said, look, there are several cases from the D.C. trial court that has upheld convictions for trespass, even though the defendants offered innocent explanations for being on the property. And, you know, why should an officer presume that he has to believe an innocent explanation from someone who's on the property? And probable cause doesn't require that. It's certainly not clearly established that it does. And so I think in it, the sort of summing up this case, it's very interesting to see the court take a very fact-bound probable cause case where even some of the issues about summary judgment and material facts were not entirely beyond dispute. And it's also a sort of interesting treatment compared to the court's other qualified immunity cases as of late, where there's been a lot of summary affirmances, summary reversals, per curiam opinions, no oral argument. The fact that this case was granted, went to oral argument, we're going to have a decision on it, you know, I think bespeaks, and we can talk a little bit more about this later, some of the, you know, bigger issues that are going on with respect to the court's current qualified immunity jurisprudence. And while the court's largely spoken with one voice on that in recent years, maybe that consensus is fraying. The next case, Class, again, also a very interesting, colorful set of facts. This case kind of begins back in May of 2013. Mr. Class, he parked a car loaded with guns, ammunition, and several knives in a permit lot about 1,000 feet from the U.S. Capitol, and then he walked to visit the U.S. Senate and House offices. While he was gone, a Capitol police officer noticed that he had North Carolina plates. He did not possess a windshield permit, and this was a permit-only parking lot. And the car also appeared to have a large blade, an empty gun holster in it, and that was in plain view. And so when Class returned to the car, he admitted to the officer that the car was his and it contained guns, and they were stored out of sight, but he had lawful permits for them. And the authorities informed him that it was illegal to have weapons on the Capitol grounds, and they arrested him for, among other things, violating a federal statute that makes it a crime to possess, quote-unquote, readily accessible firearms on the Capitol grounds. A warranted search of the car yielded that Class ultimately had three firearms and he had several knives. Again, the ownership of the weapons is not unlawful. It was the question of the possessing the firearms and readily accessible firearms on the grounds of the U.S. Capitol. Below in the trial court, Class appeared pro se, but he had what's called standby counsel, which you have the right to appear and represent yourself in court. But in criminal cases in particular, there's going to be standby counsel that will allow essentially a lawyer to kind of come in if a judge thinks that you may be really doing yourself a severe disservice in your representation. Class had filed motions challenging the federal statute that I mentioned on the ground that it was unconstitutional under the Second Amendment. He filed challenges to the parking permit on the grounds that he lacked fair notice, so this is a due process challenge. The trial court denied the motions. Mr. Class then did not appear for trial. He wrote to the court explaining that he would no longer be participating in the proceedings. He was arrested on a bench warrant. And he ultimately agreed to plead guilty to the federal weapons offense that I mentioned. Now, this is where the sort of substance of the appeal kind of comes into play. The plea agreement waived Class's appeal rights with respect to his sentence, but it did not expressly say anything about waiving the right to appeal his conviction or making any particular arguments with respect to his conviction on appeal. It also, however, didn't expressly reserve any rights to present specific issues on appeal. So there's nothing explicit in the guilty plea as to the arguments he could make about his conviction or whether or not he could challenge his conviction on appeal. The only thing explicitly waived with respect to appeal was the ability to challenge his sentence. So he was sentenced to imprisonment for 24 days of time served, a year of supervised release, and a $250 fine. He appealed. The D.C. Circuit appointed him amicus counsel, and the amicus counsel challenged the federal statute as unconstitutional under the Second Amendment and as being unconstitutionally vague under the Fifth Amendment. The federal government argued that, look, Federal Rule of Criminal Procedure 11 permits someone to issue or enter into what's called a conditional guilty plea, where they reserve certain issues they want to challenge on appeal. Class's appeal, the government said, was an unconditional guilty plea, so it waived the ability to make these constitutional challenges to the conviction itself. The D.C. Circuit released a unpublished per curiam opinion affirming the conviction. They cited its own precedent holding that unconditional pleas are knowing and intelligent. All guilty pleas have to be knowing, voluntary, and intelligent to be upheld. And knowing, voluntary, and intelligent guilty pleas, the court said, can waive claims of error on appeal, even constitutional claims. And the D.C. Circuit recognized that there are exceptions for constitutional claims, such as that the trial court lacked subject matter jurisdiction, or the defendant had a right not to be hailed into court at all. The court said that neither exception applies here, but it didn't elaborate for any reasons as to why that was so. So before the Supreme Court, Class is arguing that his guilty plea did not include an express waiver of constitutional issues on appeal, and then under what is referred to as the sort of Blackridge-Mena doctrine, which refers to two Supreme Court cases from the 1970s, Blackridge versus Perry and Mena versus New York, they both allowed criminal defendants to raise certain constitutional challenges on appeal despite pleading guilty to the charged offense. Blackledge allowed a claim of vindictive prosecution to go forward after a guilty plea because, in the court's view, that claim went to the very power of the state to bring the defendant into court to answer the charge. And Mena allowed a defendant to bring a double jeopardy claim on appeal despite a guilty plea because if the double jeopardy claim was valid, then the criminal charge was one in which the state may not constitutionally prosecute, no matter how validly his factual guilt is established. So Class is saying that his claims fall within that sort of Blackledge-Mena doctrine. The conditional guilty pleas that are discussed in Rule 11 of the Federal Rules for Criminal Procedure, that he says that the notes to that rule expressly say that the rule should not be interpreted as either broadening or narrowing that doctrine, and that his claims of Second Amendment and Fifth Amendment violations go to the very power of the state to bring him into the court and thus fall within the doctrine no matter validly his factual guilt is established. So what Class is doing here is he's kind of drawing a distinction between a guilty plea that essentially says, yes, when I plead guilty, I am admitting that the facts show that I committed X activity that you consider to be a crime. I am not saying, however, and this is Class's view, that that is in fact a legally acceptable crime. I'm just saying you have enough facts to show I committed it. The government takes a very different view, as you can imagine. It says that the unconditional guilty plea inherently waives any non-jurisdictional claims, including constitutional claims that might be presented on appeal. And a claim that the underlying criminal statute is unconstitutional does not, in the government's view, challenge the subject matter jurisdiction of the court. So in its view, it's non-jurisdictional. And outside of a conditional guilty plea through Federal Rule 11, which Class didn't have, then this is a waived question. The government takes pains to emphasize that it's not challenging the Blackledge-Mena doctrine. It just simply says this is not that, that this kind of claim is not double jeopardy, it's not vindictive prosecution, and so it's not applicable. During the course of the oral argument, it seemed as if the main question was, okay, we all understand that when you plead guilty, certain rights are waived. Certain rights are waived just as a function of pleading guilty, other rights sort of waived explicitly in the plea agreement, others perhaps by other kinds of necessary implications. But what about the rights outside of that? What about the rights that aren't explicitly waived or that aren't waived sort of necessarily as a function of pleading guilty or logically following from pleading guilty? What do we do with those rights? And how explicit or implicit does a guilty plea waiver have to be with respect to those rights? And the questions, I think, sort of fell into three sort of buckets. One bucket, I think, represented well by Justice Gorsuch, also including questions, I think, from Justice Breyer and Justice Kagan, are all sort of saying essentially what Class is saying, and for different reasons, which is that when you plead guilty, you're admitting to what's in the indictment. You're not admitting to even what the statute says. You're just admitting that the facts as pled in the indictment happened. And so on that line of thinking, then the rights that you waive when you plead guilty are the rights related to establishing those facts. So things like perhaps the statute of limitations defense or other rights that would challenge or the sufficiency of the indictment perhaps. That might be something you could waive. But other things outside of what's in the indictment, that would be something that you wouldn't necessarily waive. Justices Ginsburg and Sotomayor sort of also kind of spoke along these lines, troubled by the idea that you would be limiting the concept of rights waived by, well, it needs to be a conditional guilty plea in order to raise them, but they kind of looked at it from a different perspective than the historical and natural readings of Rule 11 and then also the historical practices. They looked at it from the perspective of, well, if we're saying that these constitutional rights can be waived implicitly, then what do we do with a case, and this is what Justice Ginsburg brought up, like Loving versus Virginia, which was a criminal case in the sense that the Lovings were prosecuted under a criminal statute, and they pled guilty, and they didn't explicitly reserve their constitutional claim should the court have not entertained their constitutional claim that there was a right to, the 14th Amendment barred discrimination on the basis of race in marriage laws. And so that really seemed to trouble both Justices Ginsburg and Sotomayor. And so there were pains taken by the government to sort of emphasize that, well, this is not that case. We're not speaking about state practices or state procedures. And states have the ability to pass statutes that say what the effect of guilty pleas in those states are. And even on the other side, Classes Council was limiting it, the scope of its rule to also what is in the federal system. It was reluctant to want to have a rule that could have implications for what states would be allowed to do in setting up their criminal procedure. So Classes' view was essentially, if there's a problem with a state-level conviction, then the remedy is the habeas corpus challenge and not some kind of federal waiver doctrine, or the Blackledge Mena doctrine. Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Alito, though, I think pushed a little bit harder on the idea that you can expand Blackledge and Mena. Justice Alito, for example, was saying, well, you can understand those cases to say that a defendant does not implicitly concede that his conviction is barred by double jeopardy. But you could understand the plea to implicitly concede that I'm guilty of the offense for which I'm charged. And that would include the facts and the law as set out in that offense. And if that's the proper understanding, well, then it sounds like Class is challenging the facts itself underlying the guilty plea. And Class's counsel took great pains to say, no, we're not challenging the underlying facts, and we're not asking the court to go back and second-guess the facts that led Class to plead guilty. We're saying something that's completely different from the facts. We're not contesting the facts. We're just saying that those facts can't constitute a crime under the Constitution. Whereas Justice Alito seems to be saying, and I think Chief Justice Roberts was picking up on this too, is that, well, if you're saying that you're guilty of the offense for which you're charged, it's not just the facts, it's the facts and the law. So that caused some trouble for Class's argument, and I think Justice Kennedy that also sort of resonated with him as well, and I think that kind of gives a good overview of where the different justices were in this case. And I think ultimately this case is a real question about where the specific constitutional rights claims at issue fall in terms of what can be waived when you're pleading guilty and how explicit you have to be when you do so. No one contests that you can waive constitutional claims. It's just a question of how explicitly they have to be given the type of claim at issue. It'd be interesting to see what ultimately happens outside of the confines of this case. Federal Rule of Criminal Procedure 11 is a heavily amended rule. It's been amended every 4 years, roughly, for the past 40 years. So it gets a lot of action, and it'd be interesting to see after this decision whether or not there's more attention paid to Federal Rule 11 and perhaps revisiting Rule 11 and what's acceptable for conditional guilty pleas and not. So I think that gives a pretty good flavor of the two cases, and happy to take questions.
Thank you, William. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, please enter the star key and then the pound key on your telephone. When we get to your request, You will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We will answer questions in the order in which they are received. Let's move to our first audience question.
Hi, this is Sean Callahan. I had a question about the Westby case. And I think this goes both to the merits question and the qualified immunity question. With respect to the facts of this case, did the district court consider this a close case? In other words, when the district court was deciding this case, did they focus on certain facts that the district court inferred meant that there was no probable cause or that the belief that there was would have been unreasonable? Or did the district court think that this was more of a close call, in which case they, on both questions, qualified immunity and probable cause, there'd be less deference to its holding?
Well, that's a good question. I think the district court's decision would not view this as a close call, and I mean, the district court had ruled that the police didn't learn anything in the house to suggest that the partygoers knew or should have known that they were entering against the owner's will. And that was the basis on which the district court found summary judgment for the partygoers and denied qualified immunity to the officers. And the standards in both summary judgment and qualified immunity are so favorable to the non-movement, as to use the summary judgment language, that the district court is almost duty-bound to not find it to be a close question. In the summary judgment context, there has to be no genuine dispute of material fact, and the moving party is entitled to judgment as a matter of law. And all inferences, all factual inferences in summary judgment are taken in the light most favorable to the non-moving party. In other words, there was cross motions, but then, from the perspective of the partygoers, the non-moving party would be the officers. And then in the qualified immunity context, again, a close call means qualified immunity attaches, because the law, remember, in order for qualified immunity to not exist, the law has to be clearly established, such that a reasonable officer would know what the law is, and if they still violated the law, then they would be, in the Supreme Court's language, either plainly incompetent or knowingly violating the law. So those aren't meant to be close call doctrines. So I don't think that the trial court viewed this as a close call, and the D.C. Circuit opinion didn't either. There was a dissent from the panel opinion and also from the rehearing en banc that obviously looked at things differently, but neither the trial court nor the panel, I think, thought this was a close call.
Thank you for your question. The queue is currently open, so if you'd like to ask a question, please enter the star key and then the pound key on your telephone. I'd like to inform our audience that tomorrow we have a special telephone call presenting a preview for the Supreme Court in October 2017 term. It will begin at 2 p.m. Eastern Time. Please keep an eye out for these emails announcing teleforum calls, and if you'd like, you can consult our website at fedsoc.org. It has a calendar of upcoming teleforum calls, as well as a list of previously recorded teleforum calls. You can listen to at your pleasure as podcasts. Still have plenty of time for questions. William, is there anything that you would like to bring up that you weren't able to in your remarks?
No, I mean, the only thing I'll say is that I personally, as between the two cases, am particularly interested in how Westby is resolved, simply because so much about this case is, in terms of the Supreme Court's usual practice on qualified immunity cases, is so unusual. I mean, as I hope my opening remarks conveyed, and I think very true from the oral argument, is that this is a very fact-heavy case, and there were disputes about the record, and there were disputes about what facts were agreed to and not, and there were questions about whether or not the counsel for the partygoers had waived or forfeited certain challenges to the factual record and only raised them at the cert stage. Very unusual to get those kinds of questions at oral argument in the Supreme Court. By that point, those kinds of things are worked out. And then on top of that, it's also unusual, given the court's sort of recent terms with respect to qualified immunity, having oral argument in a qualified immunity case. The court has had the court spoken almost with one voice in more recent years on qualified immunity. As I said, they've issued summary reversals where Court of Appeals have wrongly pierced qualified immunity. Some of those have been per curiam decisions, no dissents. Now, in some more recent years, there have been, or more recent terms, including just last term, there have been separate opinions. Justice Ginsburg and Justice Sotomayor wrote recently concern that perhaps there was a imbalance in the cases that the court was willing to review on qualified immunity, where it would review cases that had wrongly pierced qualified immunity, but it wouldn't be reviewing cases where the Court of Appeals wrongfully upheld qualified immunity. And that produced a powerful response from Justice Alito and Justice Thomas. And then also Justice Thomas himself has raised questions about the sort of historical veracity of current qualified immunity doctrine and whether or not it properly reflects the sort of common law practice that at one point perhaps it might have, but in his view it perhaps no longer does. And he went so far as to say, in an appropriate case, we should reconsider our qualified immunity jurisprudence. And notably in this case, while the focus of much of the oral argument and the briefs was on the probable cause issue, the ACLU filed an amicus brief in the case that it was not only entirely devoted to qualified immunity, but also entirely devoted to the sort of historical inquiry that Justice Thomas was teeing up in the separate opinion I mentioned. So it'd be interesting to see how that all kind of plays into the ultimate outcome. I mean, it's possible you can resolve this case without talking about qualified immunity at all, but it is interesting, even without that, to see such a sort of heavily fact-bound case come up to the Supreme Court and watch the justices, as I tried to explain somewhat amusingly, go through these facts.
Well, seeing as there are no more audience questions in the queue, William, I'd like to thank you on behalf of the Federal Society for the benefit of your valuable time and expertise today. We welcome all listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us today. This call is now adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.